9 years ago, early into his time as the owner of the LA Clippers, Steve Ballmer was worth $23.5 billion. Today, after years of spending into the NBA's luxury tax, dropping $400 million to buy the Forum from James Dolan, and spending a few billion to build a new arena for the Clippers, Ballmer is worth $154 billion, according to Forbes. He's the wealthiest team owner in the NBA and in sports, and it's not even close. He's the ninth richest man in the world. Now, as Ballmer finds himself in the middle of a league investigation for cap circumvention, his wealth is coming up as a symbol of what he might have done. It has raised a spotlight on an issue many have never thought that much about: wealth inequality in pro sports. The gap between the haves and the have-way-mores. Today, on this episode of Business Decision, we'll delve into the wealth gap in pro sports. I'm Mike Vorkunov, a reporter for The Athletic. My guest today on my show is Sarah Germano, a reporter with The Information. She wrote a really smart story about this issue earlier for The Information. Sarah, thank you for coming on. I want to talk to you about all of Steve Ballmer's billions. Are you okay in counting other people's money with me?
First of all, thank you for having me. And yes, I'm absolutely okay in counting other people's money.
Wonderful. There's a lot of money to count, first of all.
We'll be here all day.
Yeah, I think we're going to go dollar by dollar. Like, that's the most important thing. We have to make sure everything is accounted for. Much like the IRS, you cannot get anything past us.
Correct.
Yes. And so it's interesting that Steve Ballmer is the topic of this discussion and really the topic of everyone's attention for the last month or so. We'll do the TLDR on the Kawhi Leonard cap circumvention investigation if we need to. But basically, Steve Ballmer put a lot of money into this company called Aspiration that went belly up. And Aspiration paid $20 million in an endorsement deal to Kawhi Leonard, for which he did nothing, and gave him a $20 million equity deal. And the NBA is now investigating to see if this cap circumvention. That's the shortest way I can possibly put this without getting into the minutia. There's been a lot of great reporting by the Pablo Torre Finds Out podcast. I've done some reporting on my own. I'm sure more will come out, and we will talk about this ceaselessly for the next few months to a year, or however long the NBA takes with this investigation. But I thought you wrote a really smart story looking at this a few weeks ago now. I think it was early to mid-September. Time, you know, loses all value. About the huge, huge disparity about how much money owners have across the NBA and other pro sports. And Steve Ballmer is an example of that too, again, for all the many billions of dollars that he has. And I wonder if you can just kind of run through that real quick for the people who haven't read it. And you should go to The Information, subscribe, read Sarah and other people's work if you like, to know about Elon Musk's robot hands and why they're not working. That's also what you can go to The Information for. I go for Sarah, but, you know, teach their own, whatever.
Yeah, no, thank you for that intro. And first, yeah, I'll just echo what you said and say, you know, shout out to the Pablo Torre Finds Out podcast. We wouldn't be here talking about this without some of these revelations. And obviously he could, and Mike, you yourself have done a lot of reporting on the minutiae of this particular scandal. Where I come into it, where The Information comes into it, is, like you said, the reason why this sort of Aspiration story is so important is that it highlights this emerging issue in sports ownership, which is the wealth inequality among the billionaires and centimillionaires who own them. Let me be clear and say that, you know, we're not equating wealth inequality among billionaires to societal wealth inequality. Totally different discussion. But if you think about pro sports, especially American pro sports, all of which are these closed leagues, if you own an NBA team, yes, you own the Clippers, but you actually own 1/30 of the NBA. It is a collective. It has been frequently referred to as socialism for rich people because you have these revenue sharing agreements. You agree to the collective bargaining agreement with the players. There are caps on how much you can spend on payroll and so on and so forth. That is basically the, you know, Articles of Confederation, the governing principle of these sports is that you agree to share revenues and spend accordingly. And what has been happening over the last, let's say, decade plus, as, you know, Steve Ballmer has bought into the league, we've seen other highly wealthy families like the Adelson and Dumont families who bought the Mavericks recently. These leagues are accruing more and more super high net worth individuals buying into them. That's partially a function of the valuations of these teams getting higher and higher, and only a certain amount of people can afford them. But what that has created is a colossal inequality between the families that have maybe bought into these leagues decades ago, you know, early in the 20th century in some cases, to the people who are buying in today. No one is saying that if you're worth, you know, a few hundred million dollars that you're not doing so well. But when you compare that with Steve Ballmer, who today is worth over $150 billion, the amount of spending that, you know, that we are talking about with this aspiration scandal, you know, $48 million in alleged side payments to Kawhi Leonard, that is pennies in his couch cushion compared to, you know, what some of the, you know, what shall we say, like establishment owners who have owned teams in this league for a long time can spend.
Yeah. And I think it's reflective kind of where pro sports is today. It's not just us counting every owner's money, right? The leagues are doing it too in their own ways. It's why we've seen the changes that we have in baseball recently. Mm-hmm. It's why we've seen the changes that we have in the NBA recently. And it's why the NFL has always strived for a parity for all kind of model, right? They are the most socialist of leagues among these uber capitalists. And I think it's fascinating that this issue is getting worse and the leagues keep trying to look for new ways to go about it. You know, if you look at baseball for a second, the richest owner in baseball, I believe, if I remember my Forbes rankings correctly, is Steve Cohen. And baseball is trying to legislate Steve Cohen and his billions of dollars into mediocrity as much as they can. They have the Steve Cohen tax. There's all this fear-mongering now about a hard cap in the next CBA, right? And again, this is to limit people like Steve Cohen. And it's something that every league is trying to figure out. The NBA obviously did it in its last CBA by putting in the second apron. And who was that trying to limit? It's a little guy in Los Angeles named Steve Ballmer. I was curious, as someone who's looked into this, what do you think the effects of this, again, we're going to call this in a semi-serious way, wealth inequality, like what has that meant for pro sports in actuality? Like how have we seen that actually affect basketball, the NBA, the NFL, baseball, like whatever sport you want to choose, whatever example you want to give?
I think it's a good question. And maybe to answer it, we have to pan out a little bit and say, like, why is this happening? Why are there these attempted constraints around the ultra wealthy buying into these leagues? To answer that, you have to ask another question, which is why are these ultra wealthy people buying into the leagues in the first place? And that is somewhat a function of leagues needing super, super wealthy people to buy in. Steve Cohen is a great example. Who owned the Mets before Steve Cohen? The Wilpon family. Why did the Wilpon family have to sell? They made some bad investments with Bernie Madoff, you know, infamous Ponzi scheme, you know, convicted felon, lost a lot of money for a lot of people. And any Mets fan you've ever met had complained for years and years that they were so far outstripped by other teams who were able to spend more because their owners were more wealthy. When you think about the bids, rather, to buy the Mets franchise, ultimately, Major League Baseball owners who vote on who is approved to buy a team, they chose Steve Cohen because he was had the deepest pockets of anybody else bidding. And then you take into effect that was happening. Steve Cohen was buying the Mets in 2020. COVID was going on. There was a brief period, but an acute period where, you know, the economy crashed. There was this question about will live sports continue? Will we ever have live sports again? And with 5 years hindsight, we can look back and say, actually, live sports were among the most resilient businesses. You know, the demand to watch them, to attend them, you know, only increased, making them more attractive assets. So you have this dual phenomena where league owners want ultra wealthy people to buy in. They want, you know, the deeper pockets, the better. It creates a healthier league overall for everyone. And then because sports are increasingly looked at as assets, as investment decisions that generate ample returns, you get even more competition, and you have ultra wealthy people like the Adelson and Dumont family, like the Steve Cohens, who are buying these sports assets. So long-winded way of answering, partially answering your question, which is why, you know, why is this happening? What's going on? You know, the leagues are somewhat a victim of their own success. They are successfully recruiting ultra high net worth individuals to buy into these leagues, but that also creates this problem that we're highlighting today, which is what happens when one owner can spend not even hand over fist, whole body, whole, you know, school rooms of people over fist, compared to the next guy. And this aspiration scandal has the potential. And Mike, I know you and I have talked about this to some degree. A big question that we're hearing is like, to what extent are the other owners upset about this? Are they throwing hands? Are they having arguments? Are they calling up Adam Silver and complaining? And I think that will depend ultimately on the outcome of the league's independent investigation, but it has more potential than anything else to create rancor among the 30 owners.
Yeah, absolutely. And I thought, you know, in the NBA, which is the league I know the best, in 2023, they signed their new CBA, right? And to me, that was really a novel CBA, a negotiation, and a novel CBA, because every time we hear about CBA negotiations, like look at baseball now, look at the NFL, even the NBA previously, it was owners against players. Mm-hmm. Very much two sides fighting for every dollar, every percentage of revenue. This past CBA, it was owners against owners. It was an internecine affair. They wanted to limit themselves, right? It was really fascinating. They said to the players, keep your 51%. You will get your money no matter what. We want to limit how it is paid out and which teams can pay the most. And it's probably not a coincidence that this came at the very same time that Steve Ballmer was getting all his billions, right? As I said earlier, his net worth has nearly sextupled in the last 10 years. Like, that's insane. He was worth $23.5 billion before this. He is now the ninth, he's in the top 10 up there in the world. You look at Miriam Adelson, who bought in, I think a little bit after the CBA was signed, she's the second wealthiest owner in the NBA at $37.5 billion. A lot of money. Like, Steve Ballmer probably pays that in rent every month, right? Like, that's, you know, compared to what he has.
They're the next wealthiest owners in the NBA, and Steve Ballmer has four times their net worth.
That's crazy. That's insane. That's how
and
much
that's
more.
Just between one and two, you know, yeah. In rankings of NBA owners. It's crazy.
And you put out this skeet the other day about all the wealthiest, like, NBA owners. Matt Ishbia, who's in the top 10, I think he's like 7th or 8th guy. He just called himself, you know, very rich, wealthy, successful person in his press conference the other day. He's got 1/15 roughly of the money and wealth that Steve Ballmer does. So there's this very clear opportunity to use your money to your advantage. And the NBA is trying to reckon with this too. You know, it's allowing sovereign wealth funds in, it's allowing governmental investment groups like the one that just bought into the Raptors a few years ago. It's looking for private equity companies because it's running out of super wealthy people that can buy into the league. And mm-hmm. I think that will further increase kind of this difference on the top end of the owners like Ballmer and the Adelsons and whomever else eventually buys into the league, and the owners who are just getting in. You know, we just saw this. I've been doing some reporting on, much like you, on all these NBA ownership groups. And the word that's new to me that just got introduced to me, and tell me if you've heard this before, is poverty billionaire. Have you heard this phrase before?
I've heard it. I've heard it before. It was especially... it was popping up in some of my mentions when we were sharing this story. An interesting set of reactions that I think we got to writing about this was like you saw fan groups from around the NBA interpreting this through their own lens. You know, there were a lot of people like Lakers fans saying like, oh, you know, the Buss family was holding on for dear life. Like, no wonder they had to sell to Mark Walter, because to own a franchise is storied as the Lakers, but to be able to spend in this environment requires much deeper pockets. And I want to be clear, I'm not personally calling the Buss family poverty millionaires. But again, when you're talking about it within the context of the disparities between the richest and the least wealthy in this NBA system, yeah, there are orders of magnitude, different levels of wealth and different levels of investment, not just in how much money you can commit to your payroll, but upgrading your stadium, investing in other resources that owners of a large team would need to stay competitive in providing like a customer experience that would be worthwhile.
Yeah. And it's going to affect every part of sports. You know, someone like Steve Ballmer can go out and build an Intuit Dome for $2 billion and drop and another $400 million.
And not blink.
Yeah. Spend another $400 to pay off James Dolan to buy the Forum and end that beef about, I forget exactly what it was, but somehow related. And others have to bring in private equity partners. They have to bring in someone to help out with the real estate side of things, to help out with capital calls if you're losing money. And to me, it's fascinating because who your owner is, I feel like will matter way more than ever going forward in baseball, in the NBA, because you're going to need someone who can support these payrolls, who can support all these other projects that they're trying to do that you mentioned. And you have to be able to pay for a huge front office to remain competitive with the rest of the league. I wonder, because a lot of the people that we focus on are NBA owners. Is this particular to the NBA, or do we see this across other sports too, where the wealth disparity between the owners matters and where it's so obvious in the way that teams are, you know, managed and the way that teams operate?
It's a good question. And I think there are some obvious and also not so straightforward answers. The first one that comes to mind, obviously, is baseball. Baseball famously does not have a salary cap. It is a defining principle of how this league is governed. It's why baseball and its players, Major League Baseball owners and their players association have historically had really contentious labor disputes, because the players have one of the strongest unions in the country. You know, they will revolt if there is any suggestion of the imposition of any kind of salary cap. And you think about who's achieving and who are consistent winners in Major League Baseball these days. The Dodgers. They paid $1.1 billion just in one free agency period to acquire Shohei Ohtani and some additional players. I think that was it winter of 2024, about, you know, 18 months ago. And they won the World Series. They won the World Series last year. You have to spend to be competitive in baseball. That's why the Yankees had been hated for decades, because they had consistently one of the highest payrolls in the sport and had a dynastic run of World Series. So there's the baseball situation, which we can put in one bucket, but they have a slightly different governance structure without the salary cap. In the reason why NBA and the NFL are slightly different is that the NBA has a much, much smaller roster situation. NFL teams have absurdly large rosters with lots of players. You know, ultimately what you need to have a competitive NFL team is like a great quarterback and, you know, offensive linemen. But assembling an NBA team that can compete, you know, deep into the season, into the NBA finals, like, you're working with smaller rosters and you ultimately need to be more conscientious about who you're spending on, how long that bench is actually going to serve you. We're seeing this happen with the Celtics right now. The Celtics are probably the foremost example of this new NBA CBA with the second apron. You can keep a really talented, high-paid team together only for a few seasons before you start getting hit with penalties. And what have we seen? Drew Holiday is now, you know, off to
the Portland Trailblazer.
He's at Portland. Al Horford's now going to the Warriors. The whole core of that team that won the 2024 NBA Finals is now being broken up because of these new constraints in the CBA.
So do you think that this essentially billionaire proofing that the NBA is trying to do?
Ultra billionaire proofing,
can work? Because I find it fascinating. Even the two teams that everyone was trying to guard against, although let's say the other owners were trying to guard against in the last CBA talks, were Steve Ballmer and the Clippers, super wealthy, used all his money to just run into the negatives with the Clippers every year, run into the red, didn't get much for it, but nonetheless was using his money as a weapon. The other team was the Warriors, who were also spending a lot of money, but were so successful that it seems like they were able to drive enough revenue to almost break even every year. And so their losses, if they had some, were significantly smaller. And so those seem to be the two ways to like try to bend the CBA to your desires, is to either just spend all your money and not care, or to be so successful that you eventually don't care. Is one of those two ways going to be palatable going forward? And why would it be the amount of money that you have?
Well, there are only restrictions on salary cap spending. There are no restrictions on how much money you can spend on your state. Steve Ballmer could build 5 new stadiums if he wanted to.
That would be cool.
Theoretically, he could. Like, he could. I don't know why you would need 5 stadiums, but the sports experience, in other words, isn't just who you have in your starting five going out onto the floor. If you think about the totality of sports, which is an entertainment product, it's something that we consume on television or your streaming platform of choice. It is something that you buy tickets to and you take your family to. Potentially, you even buy season tickets and go several times a year. There are many different ways to consume and enjoy basketball, football, baseball. And an owner has to think about all of those factions. So spending on your payroll is one thing, but there is, and there has been, a really competitive mindset when it comes to the full consumer experience. That's why you're seeing so many of these stadiums being developed and built. You know, there was a failed effort by the Sixers organization to build their own stadium in downtown Philadelphia that basically got overruled, you know, within their own city council. But, you know, at the end of the day, all of these owners are thinking about the totality of making their team, their franchise, an overall entertaining experience. And salary cap is just, or the salary payrolls are just one function of what it takes to be a great source of entertainment for your local community.
Yeah. And you mentioned the Sixers. I would say they're an example of how much wealth matters and how it's leveraged in other ways across sports. Josh Harris and David Blitzer bought into the Sixers in 2011. They have since bought the Washington Commanders. Mm-hmm. They have bought the New Jersey Devils. David Blitzer has a stake in the Cleveland Guardians that I think will allow him to become a majority owner in some amount of time. So that is the other interesting part about kind of these super billionaires getting into sports now, is that a lot of them are not stopping at just one team. They are building little fiefdoms across multiple pro sports leagues. And when there used to be rules against this, there is not anymore. And I think it's part of what you said recently, which is all these leagues need super high net worth individuals. There's only a finite amount of them. And so they are now owning teams across multiple sports.
Right. The multi-club ownership model is something that we've been seeing develop basically through the 21st century. And there are effectively two kinds of multi-club ownership models. I think the Harris Blitzer kind is one very important one. You're seeing them. They have stakes in teams in different leagues, in different cities. They have, you know, European football as well. Very popular for billionaire owners to have a portfolio of both American sports and European or global sports. And that's a full-time job in itself. And then the other example I would say is maybe the Mark Walter, Guggenheim Partners. They've cornered the market on Los Angeles. Now they have the Lakers, they have the Dodgers, they have the Sparks. They're effectively, you know, outside of Steve Ballmer, controlling a large swath of LA sports. And if you think, you can think about it from a couple different perspectives. If you think about it from a fan perspective of any of these teams, do you want an owner who is potentially his or her interests are divided among 6 or 7 clubs around the world, and one week they're spending on this or one week they're spending on that? Do you want someone who can give your team like their undivided attention and the lion's share of whatever discretionary income they're going to devote to making that team better? And then a third thing I would say is just, again, with the LA example, if you have one group or one individual who controls a plurality of the professional sports teams in that area, does that make you vulnerable to any kind of, you know, financial crisis or liquidity event that that person may face down the road. Again, we'll say, fingers crossed, knock on wood, we're not hoping that happens to anyone, but it does present a risk, right? Like if one person or one group controls a bunch of the sports teams in your town, like, are you not considering the risk that may have if they were ever to face some kind of liquidity event of their own?
Yeah. And I would say the other side of that is if you own three of the teams in one city, do you not become one of the most powerful people in that in that city all of a sudden, right? You know, the difference between someone who is extremely wealthy and someone who's extremely wealthy and owns a pro sports team is immense. The amount of social capital and perhaps political capital they have suddenly goes up by a lot too.
It's a major reason why buying these assets is so attractive to people with high net worth. Like, again, to go back to the Steve Cohen example, he's a hedge fund trader by profession, by reputation. His original hedge fund, SAC Capital Partners, paid a record fine to the SEC to settle insider trading allegations. Not a great thing to have on your resume. But Steve Cohen had been a lifelong devoted Mets fan, had some of the deepest pockets, one of the richest men in the world, and came in with a passionate and ultimately winning, bid and campaign to buy the Mets and restore them to the modern day of baseball competition by spending on top players. They signed Juan Soto away from the Yankees this year. They have plans to expand the Flushing development area. They're bidding for a casino over there. So again, having these deep-pocketed billionaires, ultra-billionaires, come in and revitalize the area around where your team plays is an attractive possibility or an attractive scenario for fans and, for individuals like Steve Cohen who want to rehabilitate or, add another chapter to their legacy, if you will. Like, owning a sports team and refurbishing it is not a bad way to do that.
Yeah, although the way this Mets season is gone, Steve Cohen may hope that, the SEC was the worst of his problems, the way that Mets fans are, because they can come down a lot worse
than the federal Mets. You still have to, spending will only get you so far, I guess, is the lesson there.
Well, that is the big lesson here, right? The NBA, for all of its second apron hoopla and all the, concerns about spending and all that, like a very top line look at the history of the league. I looked at this back a few years ago when the second apron was coming into effect. There was no guarantee that spending a lot of money bought you a championship or even got you into the conference finals. What guaranteed you that was having LeBron James, Steph Curry, or Kevin Durant. Now, those teams, once they acquired said players, spent a lot of money, but they acquired them. Steph Curry was drafted. Kevin Durant was drafted by the Thunder at the time. LeBron James was drafted, then left. And so he's got some, ancestral ties to Cleveland area. So it's whether even having all of this money is such a leg up. And I think that's the fascinating part, because the leagues and the teams will tell you there's an immense, immense value to it that gives you a competitive advantage that can't be accounted for in other ways. And maybe that's true in baseball. We see that with the Dodgers, right? But even they don't win the World Series every year. Other teams do. And the Yankees haven't won a World Series since 2009. Which every Yankees fan will tell you and yell at you for hours, right? So, what is the limits to the value of all this money?
It's a great question, and the Yankees example is such a funny and interesting one. Like, the Yankees have been called the quote unquote evil empire for ages because they were the richest team for so long and won so many championships, 27 rings, famously, because they had the deepest pockets in baseball for so long. And now, they haven't won a World Series since 2009. They're frequently outspent by the Dodgers, by the Mets, by, until recently, the Boston Red Sox, which we'll get to in a second. And yeah, there are limits to how much money can get you in terms of it's harder to buy a championship these days. I think one function of that is also something else that came from baseball, the money ball concept, the idea that you could be spending smarter, not harder. Not maybe the best metaphor, but you see where I'm going with that. And tech analytics have made assembling rosters and developing offensive strategies and defensive strategies like much, much, much more sophisticated. So it's not, like you said, it, even as recently as 10, 15 years ago when you just needed to assemble a bunch of stars and, you know, there's a pretty good chance you're going to make it to the finals. I wanted to also mention, like, so we've been talking about this multi-club ownership model, like the Red Sox are another great example. Mm-hmm. John Henry and Fenway Sports Group are one of the preeminent examples of a multi-club ownership model. They have the Red Sox. They have Liverpool Football Club over in England. They have the Pittsburgh Penguins. And they've been, the Red Sox fans have slammed the Henrys for years about how they are not spending and have been consistently a non-factor in the postseason, not even hoping for a World Series. Not having a realistic hope of a World Series run. And, you know, I spent a lot of time actually with the Henry family. I did a magazine profile on them last year. And, you know, you can look at it that way and say, you know, the Red Sox have been far outspent by the Dodgers and the Mets and all these other teams. Or you could say, well, they had one of the most famous World Series droughts in history. And it wasn't until the Henry family bought the club, refurbished it in its own way and brought four championships, you know, this century. And so, you know, John Henry is now involved in a bunch of other things. He's one of the architects of this new professionalization of golf, the PGA Tour. And, you know, is his attention on the Reds as much on the Red Sox as, you know, fans would like to see? Maybe not. But that, again, to what we were talking about, this multi-club ownership model, like you accrue all this money, you accrue all this power, you become a good operator of sports franchises. And there is this drive to extend that expertise to a variety of projects. At the end of the day, one thing we haven't talked about yet is like the competitors on the floor, the owners themselves are quite competitive people. And that drives a lot of their decision making too. But you can layer in all of these risks. You know, how much is their attention going to any given club at any different given time? How deep are their pockets? What is their net worth compared to the other owners in the league? And then ultimately, how competitive is that league? When you consider the amount of analytics, the amount of strategy, basketball strategy, baseball strategy, you know, football strategy. There are a lot of different ways to be successful and also a lot of different ways to use your money and influence to give your team a better chance.
Yeah. And it's going to be fascinating what happens here, because I think this controversy, this cap circumvention controversy, if we take it down the road for a minute, of let's say this has an air of real actual scandal there and is something that is true. The last major cap circumvention situation that the NBA had was around the year 2000, and it was the Minnesota Timberwolves. And I'm sure a lot of people have done a lot of Wikipedia deep diving on this. But that time, it was Joe Smith getting three supremely under market contracts, three 1-year deals, to then sign a, I think, $86 million contract, which was his market rate. So he had to take a haircut to eventually get the big payoff. Mm-hmm. Whereas this time, Kawhi Leonard took no haircut. Kawhi Leonard got his market rate, and then he got some more on top of that, which is maybe, if anything else, an interesting way to look at the different place that the NBA and other pro sports leagues find themselves now, which is even the mechanics of if there is impropriety are different than they used to be.
Completely. I was, you know, as I was writing the story we're referencing for the information just about the wealth inequality in the NBA, something my editor and I had talked about was this idea of, you know, potentially, and I'll make a lukewarm claim here. I think that the analysis of spending or potential impropriety, financial impropriety by front offices will be the sort of the scandal of the 21st century, the way that, you know, doping scandals were the shock and awe scandals of the 20th century. With much more invested in sports financially and emotionally, and, you know, this relatively new idea that sports are not just great entertainment, but great assets. There will be a lot more attention, emotion, and overall importance placed on the way your front office operates and any allegation of impropriety. We're seeing it now with the allegations around Ballmer and the Clippers is generating a lot of discussion such that you and I are talking about it right now, such that, you know, there have been other podcasts and articles written about this aspiration scandal. This is going to be the thing that will titillate the sports community in a way that I think, you know, we're well aware of, like, doping scandals from the 20th century. And some of that is just kind of like baked into your expectation. There's a lot of runway in terms of how much risk is available in front office spending.
Yeah. And I think the funny thing is, successful Steve Ballmer was in his business career, his actual career, and all these people are. It's the stuff that you do in sports that ultimately may be what people remember you for, because Steve Ballmer might be successful Microsoft billionaire, but in a few years, or when it's all said and done, he might be Steve Ballmer, guy who potentially cheated with the Clippers, right? Like, or guy who did or did not win a title with the Clippers. And this is something that I think will be the case for a lot of pro sports owners now. The sports will go in front of what your business accomplishments are.
Completely. And I mean, if it's quite possible, you know, Steve Ballmer, I think, is quite famous because, you know, look, he was with Microsoft in the 1990s. He's hugely influential in Silicon Valley. And I think, you know, one thing we haven't pointed out is part of why his net worth has exploded so much is because he maintains his interest in Microsoft. They've gotten so far into the AI game that has driven, you know, Microsoft's market cap and Steve Ballmer's own net worth, you know, through the stratosphere. But to people who are, you know, maybe not paying attention to tech dailies, they are equating Steve Ballmer and his reputation, as you said, with his interest in sports. And I think one other component of this that I think must actually be hard to wrap one's head around is if you've made enough money in your career to afford to buy a sports team, you're probably, you know, used to getting your own way or finding, you know, any way to succeed, to, you know, take market share from the competition. It doesn't work that way in sports. It's a totally different operating playbook. You have to, you know, play by the rules. There is, like we said, that expectation of revenue sharing and, you know, governing as a collective. And, you know, I personally wonder, there are diverse personalities who own sports teams. It's not to to paint them as one monolith, but if you're coming from a background of intense competitiveness, what that must mean to have a mental shift to, okay, like, now I'm operating as a sports owner and it's not quite as elbows out. You have to be collegial with your fellow owners.
Yeah. And some of them are not that collegial all the time, which is the other fun part of it.
Right.
I'll end it there. Sarah, thank you so much for coming on to the show. Is there anything that you want to plug? Anything that we should know about any of your works?
Oh, goodness. Well, first of all, thank you so much for having me. Great conversation. I'm sure we'll have many more front office economics to discuss in the future. I would say if you're not familiar with The Information, the outlet that I write for, we are a woman-owned and woman-founded daily publication, internet-based publication based out of Silicon Valley. I'm based in New York, but we cover the tech industry, finance, sports business, media, and a lot of other fun things. So yeah, if you're looking to explore a little bit more into stuff we've alluded to here about, like, the role that AI has played in the advancing net worth of some of these people who are buying sports teams and influencing your local community, Information's a good place to read up on it.
Yeah. And if you're not, you should be reading Sarah. You should be reading The Information. When you come back on, maybe we can do an episode on the segment we didn't have time for today about the pentathlon horse punching controversy. That will have to be another show, unfortunately.
Stay tuned.
For Sarah, I'm Mike Vorkunov. Thank you for watching and listening to Business Decision. Take a moment and to subscribe to the YouTube channel. It'll all be worth it in the end. I appreciate it. And we'll catch you on the next episode of the show.